Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the Armchair Survivalist. My name is Kurt Wilson. I'm the Armchair Survivalist. Today is June the 20th in the year 2021. Happy Father's Day to everybody out there. If you go to armchairsurvivalist.com, you scroll down to the bottom of the page, and you will see all the different ways to listen to me. I'm pretty much on every podcast venue known to man. I'm on satellite. There's a phone number you can dial in to listen to me. The only thing I'm not on anymore is shortwave. So that's a whole different story. But anyway, armchairsurvivalist.com, you can read about me. You can look at, go in the chat room. And you can listen to me live on Sundays. Not really live, because I'm cutting my show before, and I'm putting it in the can, so to speak. And then I upload it to my engineer, Todd, and he sends it to the satellites and all the different podcast places. The best podcast place there is Anchor.fm. Now, there's Pandora people use, Google and Apple and all of this other weird stuff. But my main host is Anchor.fm, and then they disperse it to all the different weird places. So anyway, let me give you some information about my company at SurvivalEnterprises.com. If you go to SE1.us, you can find us, SurvivalEnterprises.com, you can find us. Look on there. We specialize in health products that keep you alive, but we got all kinds of other things too. And we're going to be having inventory changes. Things change. What we have for sale changes, and we're doing everything we can to keep afloat. Because, well, I don't know if you know this, but over 40% of small businesses disappeared because of this intentional destructive close down that we were forced to go through. When the governor of Idaho told everyone, you got to close your business, and I'll make this very simple, I said no. There were a few other words added to that, but basically it was no. Then when that same communist comes out and says, now y'all got to wear masks, my response was no. Of course, again, there was a lot of other words added to that. So basically, Survival Enterprises stayed open during the whole close down. The thing was, is that so many sheep out there, sheeple, as I coined the phrase, believed that everything was deadly and dangerous and they needed to stay in their homes. Well, they didn't go out and buy a lot of stuff. So we didn't have a lot of income. And we are barely keeping ourselves above water. We're doing fine now and things are slowly picking up. But over 40% of all small businesses in the United States closed down, went bankrupt. Some states, it was like New Mexico, 75%. Whereas the big box stores were considered essential, so they were open. Costco, Walmart, Home Depot, Lowe's, they got to stay open. But all the small stores either succumbed because they're sheeple as well, or they didn't. You know, we got a problem in the United States. The concept of American has been eradicated. An American wouldn't fall for this crap. I didn't. My wife didn't. My son didn't. And many other American stores didn't. Some of them are now fighting in court. Idaho's a little different. But regardless of that, in the economy, we're lucky to even have an economy right now. It's gotten to the point where everything is ready to just fold over. Everything is. The stock market, yeah, you're looking at all of these big giant corporations going up and up and up and up in value. And well, this past week was pretty bad, but generally, they're making money. And the reason is they have nothing to do with America. They're all over the world. The Dow 30 is no longer an American institution. It's worldwide, and that's the bad thing. I don't know if you guys remember this. Remember in 2008, 2009, when malls started to close because of the collapse of the market, of the real estate market? Well, it's starting over again. Major mall owner. This company, it's called Washington Prime Group. Major. Owns over 100 locations in the United States, filed for bankruptcy. A store inside a mall is told to shut down. Now, they're not told, we're going to pay your lease for you. They're just told shut down. So these companies aren't paying the money. They're not paying for the lease. They can't. They physically can't. They're not making the money. And so this mall owner's not getting paid. Well, if he's not getting paid, well, then he can't make his mortgage to the lender that loaned him the millions of dollars to buy that mall or to build that mall. This is a domino effect that's not just affecting businesses, like large businesses like this. It's also affecting tenants. It's also affecting real estate. In many of the cities and states, they have basically said, you know, you don't have to pay your rent because you're not making money, so don't worry about it. Well, that's great for them, for the tenant, but for the landlord or for the owner of that property, well, how the hell is he supposed to pay his bills? This whole thing was planned, by the way, for the destruction of the economy of the United States. This is how socialism gets in here. This next year, you're going to hear millions of people and businesses say, well, we're screwed. What are we going to do? You got to come and help us. You got to help us. Help us. And that's exactly what the communists want. They want us to beg them to help them. Now, obviously, we're under the category economy here. You got to be careful what's going on around you. I've said this so many times, it's redundant. Especially if you're on the internet. You've been hearing about different places being shut down, different businesses being hit, and then all of a sudden, bam, big businesses are being hit with cyber warfare and ransomware. There's a lot of stuff that can affect us individually. If you are dependent on the internet in any way, shape, or form, then you can be shut down. Just like banks have been shut down. We're talking just last past couple weeks. Banks have been shut down. Airlines have been shut down. Garbage trucks have been shut down. There are so many different things that are affected and controlled now by the internet. People have no clue. Your sewage system, the freshwater system, is all controlled by the internet. Banks are controlled by the internet. Unfortunately, you give your own personal information to all kinds of different websites out there. Amazon, Facebook, Apple, eBay, over 26 million accounts have been hacked. If any of you have accounts on any of those, go and change your password. And these internet companies are doing more and more and more to collect more and more data from you so that they can control you in various circumstances. Now, you have... Not everyone, but too many people have these Amazon Dots or Google Dots or whatever the hell it is. Alexas, you know, these smart speakers, these smart devices. I mean, I saw refrigerators that are smart, all right? Well, the problem is Amazon created something and it went live June 8th, this last week. It's called Amazon Sidewalk. Now, let me tell you what this does. It will automatically connect all wireless smart devices, including Alexa and Echo speakers and Ring cameras, to what's known as a mesh wireless network. Okay? Amazon will be doing this. You don't have an option. I mean, you can, and I'll tell you how. But what happens is it's creating this called Amazon Sidewalk. And the purpose of this is so everybody will have access to the internet, your internet. You're going to become part of this mesh wireless network. Years ago, I used to have this Vonage handheld phone. And when I travel and I want to make a phone call, I have to be on the internet. Well, you know, a lot of time I'm not on the internet while I'm traveling, so I just drive down a street, a residential street, until I found an open Wi-Fi or open router. I'd patch into it, make my phone call, and then disconnect. Now, it's not that that was illegal. It was unethical. Now, with this Amazon Sidewalk thing, if you have any smart devices in your house, you have just decided and agreed that you're going to be allowed to be hooked up to everybody. This is so anybody can access internet no matter where they are. Now, there's ways you can opt out. There's an app. The Alexa app tells you how to do it. There's various other ways you can do it, and I'll have the post up that you can figure it out and change your passwords and opt out of this stuff. But basically, this is Skynet from the Terminator. This is everything that's on the internet, including your watch, your phone, your router, your doorbell, your TV, everything. You need to change and upgrade your security. Otherwise, you're part of it. This is disgusting. And then if somebody hacks that, well, they can take everything down. Do you remember when Trump came out and said, we're banning TikTok? This is the program that people use to make fools of themselves. Okay, so Dimwit and the rest of the commies in charge of the U.S. right now have decided that just because TikTok is owned and controlled by a communist Chinese government doesn't mean it shouldn't be allowed to function within the United States. So they rescinded all the threats to TikTok and said, go ahead. So TikTok comes out and says, basically, well, thank you. And by the way, we're going to start collecting all of the face prints and fingerprints that people have used on our service, and we're going to keep them, gathering biometric data on everyone. Here's a unique function. Now, sometimes people have this function on their phone where to unlock it, they got to put their fingerprint on there. Well, TikTok's going to download that. And every time you go on there and you put your face on there and people see your face and you're talking and whatever, TikTok is going to take that and they're going to download that and they're going to copy that. So everything you do on TikTok is now going to the Chinese Communist government, which most people aren't going to be able to tell the difference between theirs and ours. Now, I mentioned cyber attack and how things can affect you, what various things can be affected. It's a very hard thing to explain every single aspect, everything that can be that can affect you. But there are so many different things. All trucking is controlled by the internet. You didn't know that? You don't just get in a truck anymore and drive. They have electronic log systems in trucks. They have GPS systems in trucks. These GPS systems, they communicate back to dispatch for that trucking company, and it tells dispatch where that truck is and how long it's going to be before it gets to where it's going. And based on that data, dispatch can then say, okay, so he's going to drop his load at 10 a.m. So he's going to have time by 1 o'clock, 1 p.m. to pick up another load. So let's schedule that. That goes down. Truck driver's going to sit there going, what do I do now? Most pumps at gas stations are connected directly to your bank, right? Use your debit card or what have you. Those are going to go down. Forget about the banks. They're all going down, period. All utility systems, they're run by computers. Electric, water, natural gas, water treatment facilities. The simple security of your personal information is protected via programs on the internet. Pretty much all government operations would go down. And again, the transportation systems, not just the trucking. Trains, subways, and planes are 100% relied, they rely on internet-connected computers. Traffic management systems. But in Coeur d'Alene, sometimes the traffic lights go down, and they default to flashing red lights. Those are all hooked to the internet. And of course, air traffic control. That's hooked to the internet. Everyday trade. My business. Somebody comes in and they give me a credit card. Well, if the internet goes down, I can't take that. A lot of companies use special computerized cash registers that they communicate directly with banks. Now, we don't use that, but those places will go down. Telecommunication systems. Like, I rely on VoIP, Voice over Internet Protocol. That's how I'm recording this show and most of my shows. Well, if that goes down, what do I do? When I first started my radio show on GCN, I actually used my cell phone and I called in. And all these smart systems that people have all over their house, how to unlock the doors and lock the doors and turn the heat on and get rid of the heat and turn the AC on and all of this stuff, that they're gone. They're done. You need to be dependent as little as possible on the internet, because it's not if, it's when it goes down or is hacked to such a degree that you don't dare go on it anymore. We're going to the health category right now. I don't know how many of you go to Hal Turner's website. This is HalTurnerRadioShow.com. I've known Hal for many, 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 many years. I used to advertise on his show. He gets information that either never shows up in the media or shows up 2 to 5 days after he gets it. The U.S. government, and he has a picture of the material transfer agreement right here. U.S. government sent mRNA coronavirus vaccine candidates to university researchers weeks before COVID outbreak in China. You get that? The government, the federal U.S. government, was transferring some of these vaccine candidates, specifically owned by Moderna, to a university almost 20 days before the outbreak of the virus happened in China. I'm going to have this on my show notes so you can all look at it. All over the world, people who have been vaccinated, it seems makes no difference whether they're vaccinated or not vaccinated, they're still going to get sick from this so-called COVID-19, and they're going to die. People are dying in Maine. Vaccinated people are ended up with this disease dying, and it's discovered that people are going to die 20% more if they're vaccinated than unvaccinated people are. Vaccinated children are developing inflammation of the heart tissue is what it is. And it's as a matter of fact, the CDC was going to have a big meeting because it was so important, because so many children were getting vaccinated and then having their hearts almost stop beating. Well, they canceled that meeting because not enough people have died, I guess. It doesn't really make matters important enough to them, because we don't care. See, we're not screaming about it. It's just a kid, right? We're going to pop out another one. It doesn't make any difference. Here's something that does make a difference. And this, last week, I had a doctor that I played who was talking about what the spike protein does. So I got an article from the International Journal of Infectious Diseases. First case of post-mortem study in a patient vaccinated against SARS-CoV-2. Here's what happened. So this guy died. They did an autopsy on him. He got a single dose of vaccine. He developed basically problems and died 4 weeks later. And what they found was this spike protein was in all organs, and it looked as if this disease was injected into him. He died from acute renal and respiratory failure, but it was the vaccination that killed him, not the disease. And because of this data that's popping up all over the internet, the communist governments can't control it as much as they want. So now the U.S. government is going to spend an extra $3 billion on quote-unquote vaccine hesitancy propaganda ads. Vaccine hesitancy. That was the button they come up with to invalidate people who wouldn't take this kill shot. Now, I've got a clip here. It's a combination of three different clips. The first one is where an investigator is working on the internet, and he discovered that the government has hidden over 150,000 deaths from vaccine in the United States. Okay. Then there's a woman talking, and she'll explain the whole thing. But this is where it starts getting upsetting, if you can believe that. And then there's an article talking about people who have gotten a vaccine and flying.
150,000 deaths have been erased by the CDC, according to the latest VAERS research. Our first example is case ID 966236. If we go to the VAERS website and we punch in 966236, it shows us nothing. But just a few months ago, ID 966236 was attributed to a 67-year-old male from Florida who was given the Pfizer vaccine and died. That case is gone. It's been erased. And it's not the only one. There are 150,000 cases, just like this one, that have disappeared. Now, if we enter in 966235, for example, the case is there. If we enter in 966237, the case is there. So all of these numbers that you're going to see are in fact in chronological order, and they should all be there, but they're not. And so let us show you some samples, starting with the earliest known record to have disappeared, 916605. That one has not disappeared. It's come back. Seems like they've been busy they're busy replacing these numbers. That's one thing that we've seen, is that some of these numbers are being replaced. As we speak, they're busy trying to cover up the evidence. Okay, so 916-616 is still gone. But they're replacing these numbers with people that haven't died. So they're moving quickly. But they're starting to get the drift that people are catching on. 916-673 was another one that was flagged. That's back. And that person didn't die.
To this day, I am running a global gas and oil recruitment firm. And the reason that this is important is because of what I am seeing as an executive in this industry happening right now as a result of the COVID vaccines. And it's something called succession planning. Basically what it is companies need to plan for what's going to happen as their staff move on, rather they move up the line, they retire, so on and so forth. Succession planning is something that I help companies with professionally by offering them recruitment services. So they'll come to me and say, hey, we're going to need 100 guys to, you know, staff this rig, so on and so forth. And so we'll provide them that service. Well, what's really interesting, what's happening right now, and it's actually mortifying, not just interesting, is that executives are having their HR staff and their managers, superintendents, foremen, so on and so forth, go through and look at the staff that have received the vaccines, and they're planning to have to replace them all within the next 3 years. It's got some of these guys literally in tears as they're going through the company and literally checking off all of these individuals that have taken the vaccine, knowing that most likely in the next 3 years, they're going to have to plan to replace that person. This is a really big thing in the industry that I'm in, and a lot of talk going on around this at the moment, because these massive companies, massive gas and oil companies, are looking to have to replace thousands of personnel. And I'm in that line of work that does the staffing for these large gas and oil companies. They're pretty petrified as for what's going to happen to their staff, but also their businesses, because they project that they're going to lose, roughly half of their personnel.
Well, here's another inconvenient truth. In other parts of the world, airlines are now advising people who have been vaccinated not to fly. Yep, you heard me correctly. Airlines in Spain and Russia are warning people who have been vaccinated against coronavirus not to travel because of the risk of blood clots. Now, this is a well-known risk of long-haul flights, but it apparently is exacerbated by the potential side effects, the clotting side effects of the COVID-19 vaccines. It's just another sign that there really isn't anybody in a position of authority you can truly trust anymore.
I can go on this vaccination bogus crap. Hundreds of Asian healthcare workers who were vaccinated are now sick. It's getting worse worldwide, and they can't hide it that much now, because you're going to start seeing people next to you or even in your own household that are going to end up sick and dying. Based on various forms of data and what's transpiring worldwide right now, pretty much anyone who's taken the vaccination will end up dying within 5 years or being totally bedridden from some weird, strange, obnoxious disease that pops up out of the blue and doctors have no clue how to treat it. Now, I had a friend, and this is totally off the wall. I had a friend contact me. He's been in intelligence now for 50 years, and he works for the Air Force. He said, I have a theory. And a bunch of us got together and we developed this theory. And it's not what you would think. So I said, well, why don't you tell it to me? I said, okay. The elites have discovered and realized that the world is being populated by too many stupid people. Too many stupid people to guarantee the survival of the race, the human race. So they want to figure out a way that these stupid people can be eradicated without actually going through and pulling them out and shooting them. Now, this, you got to put this together. And I have said this before. Chemtrails. Now, you got to put chemtrail thing together, okay? Chemtrails, to me, and I was looking at them, and I've looked at the breakdown of the ingredients that have been in the chemtrails, and I said, and I've told people this, this looks to me like a binary, meaning two-part toxin. See, there's binary means it takes two innocuous parts to go together to create a third substance. Like there's a thing called tannerite, and you take this one substance and this other substance, and they don't do anything besides themselves. By themselves, nothing. Put them together, mix them well. Now they're an explosive. So he goes, okay. So we think that the chemtrails are putting out different products, different chemical solutions that prep the human body to accept a mild, innocuous disease, and then at will they'll launch it, the little disease. Okay, the next thing you know, the flu season pops up, and millions of people worldwide are getting sick. His theory was that these people that got sick, the ones that believed what the doctors were saying, died. The ones that wouldn't use ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, other products that were proven to fight coronaviruses, those are the people that died. And he said, now that wasn't good enough. Now we have to convince them that they need to take this vaccine, which is not a vaccine. In fact, the FDA won't even authorize it as such. It's a genetic manipulation. He said the stupid people will be taking this shot. He said, all in all, when this is all done, the majority of stupid people will be dead. I don't think he's going to post that on Facebook or anything, but, you know. Anyway, now we got to get into the food section. I'm sure most of you have heard the term Dust Bowl, and that was the term for the Midwest when the topsoil dried out and became dust. We're looking at that again. The Corn Belt itself, the area in the Midwest that most corn is grown on, has lost a third of its topsoil. All these things I'm talking about will be on my show notes, especially for this show. The main thing we have to worry about in farmland is the surface soil moisture, okay? The surface soil has to be able to hold moisture. And it has to be in the surface soil. And we're at the lowest rating in 20 years right now. We're, based on all of this data, we're looking at another dust bowl. And that's, we don't need anything else along with what we got. By the way, you know, remember, and I talked about this, and everybody talked about this, and it was on TV and all of that. It was about the genetically modified salmon. People call it Frankenfish. And how great it's going to be, and it's going to be, they're going to farm it, and they grow fast, they get fat, they're full of omegas. Just because they're genetically modified doesn't mean it's going to hurt anybody, right? Well, a federal judge came out and said that is unlawful, and all of them are to be destroyed. There's more to it than that, but I thought, that's interesting. Out of the blue, this federal judge says, nope, kill them all. That's disgusting. There is a shortage of cans. Now, I used to work for American Can. We made cans. We made cans for Del Monte. We made cans for various other companies in the Sacramento area that canned tomatoes. We actually had, there was a can shortage, and it was created because the union went on strike and stopped manufacturing cans. So there was a can shortage. So there were thousands and thousands of tons of tomatoes that were literally left to rot. It was so bad, you could be driving down Highway 99 and you would smell rotting tomatoes. It was gross. It was worse than driving through an area in Nevada and coming up a hill and coming right into one of the largest slaughterhouses there were, and a stench of cow urine and poop and all of this crap. No, it was worse than that. Right now, in Italy, which is one of the largest exporters of tomatoes, they've got a can shortage.
We're witnessing a series of cascading failures in our supply chains between shortages of containers, shipping issues, and we continue to hear quotes like, there's no end in sight, rates are continuing to skyrocket, shortages are now abound. Everything we've seen to date is just the rising vibes of this, and the true crisis still lies ahead, still unrealized because the damage is ongoing and worsening. So when we see headlines like this one today from Bloomberg, which is a perfect case study in how all of these disruptions cascade and cause further interruptions to production and distribution, and that includes with our food supply, and this is the bell I've been ringing, right? So here from Bloomberg, Italy's tomato harvest is threatened by can shortages. Quote, tomato sauce on your spaghetti may be harder to come by this year as a global shortage of steel sheets to make cans for food production risks Italians leaving tomatoes in the fields to rot. Quote, we cannot find cans. Big multinationals are defaulting on their contracts and declaring force majeure, and the price of cans has increased by more than 3 times, according to the CEO of Atlanta, which is an Italian fine food retailer that hits US, UK, India, Japan, Canada, right? These are global markets that are affected by this because, in fact, Italy is one of the world's top producers of tomatoes, churning out about 5 million tons each year. That season is from July to September, which we're about to hit, and you need to can those tomatoes promptly after harvest in more than 36 hours. So disruptions means tomatoes will be thrown out. That's it. You lose your food because you don't have cans. Quote, we don't know how long this shortage will last. There is no end of the tunnel in sight. There's that phrase again, right? No end in sight on the shipping containers. No end in sight on the fact that we can't even package up our food that we did grow. And then there are other farmers who can't get the supplies they need to feed their animals or to grow food in the first place. If you take nothing else from this, this is not about the fact that there'll be tomato sauce shortages. That's noteworthy. But the bigger deal is the real damage hasn't even started yet. And we're already experiencing massive blows to our global food supply. All of tomatoes in Italy just rotting away because there's no steel. Because in fact, we right here, demand for cans is being absorbed by China, whose economy recovered sooner than the rest of the world, and therefore even Italian steel producers and others in Italy are not able to deliver to their own domestic customers. They've prioritized China, the foreign buyer, over their own domestic buyers, which means that their crops are going to rot now. It's really a stunning situation. And again, stepping back, it's not just tomatoes and cans, as illustrated by this gentleman who posted in my Telegram group, was posting that he runs 25,000 pigs and 80,000 birds, and while they have stocked away some basic commodities and have a generator, you know, basic preparedness, the bottom line there is that if they don't get their feed in from Cargill, if they don't have their premixed minerals and their protein supplements coming in each week, the whole thing breaks down. And so I really want to impress upon people today, because a lot of folks think, oh, it's a farm, and they have this still, this iconic image of a self-sufficient homestead that produces more food than they can eat, and so they sell to the rest of them. That's not what a farm is in big ag terms anymore. These are places that are just stops along the supply chain that depend wholly on those deliveries coming in, and also on the animal, as he says down here, we need our barn space to rotate consistently. So if there's any backup, and this is what I've mentioned when the meat plants shut down and during the JBS cyber attack, is that these things cascade quickly back to producers who are then stuck with animals. The point, though, is that Jimmy Pigson is, and our food supply in general, like these tomatoes, is just as brittle, is just as fragile in bespoke and just in time as the rest of our supply chain. So when we see headlines like we're in a shipping crisis and there are shortages and there's going to be this cascading series of failures, that includes food production. And you've got to get ready for that. You've got to set away some food right now. You've got to start growing food and warn your community and start them growing food. We've got to brace for the emergency that we can see. This is that we are looking right at right now.
And this is what gets me and my friends and my wife and my son. We can see this with all the data and research we do during the week. We can see what's happening and we can see what's coming. Now, granted, and thank God for this, the majority of the sky is falling that you've heard for the past 20 years has not come to fruition. And that's through the acts of people like me who is out there warning everyone that this crap is coming. I don't know what's going to happen from this. I know that I'm prepared, but I don't know what's going to happen to everyone else. All right, now we're going to get into the liberal psychosis.
If you lie to the government, they'll put you in prison. But when they lie to all of us, it's called being a politician. You think taking guns away will save our kids from the killings? But you're pro-choice, abortion kills way more children. If America's so terrible and racist, it probably isn't safe to encourage immigration. Just saying, all the contradictions are embarrassing. You know who hates America the most? Americans. Trigger warnings used to be on TV for seizures, and now they're everywhere to protect millennials' feelings. He, she, his, him, hers, them, they. Screw a pronoun, cause everyone's a retard these days. I hear him preaching at the protest that hatred's the problem, but hating straight men, white folks, and Christians is common. Coca-Cola telling people they should be less white. They preach intolerance, but if you disagree, they fight. There's a race war here, elections based on fear. Black lives only matter once every 4 years. Soldiers died for this country, and every one of us benefits. Give welfare to the bums, then forget about the veterans. Black folks and white folks divided by the news, but we are all the same. We are red, white, and blue. Ashamed to be American? Okay, that's cool. Cause honestly, we are all ashamed of you too.
Y'all are so fake, oh no. The forecast said that there'd be snowflakes. Whoa, you can't make us see it your way. No way, gasoline and propane. More flames.
You guys ought to go on YouTube and look up Tom McDonald. This is that white rapper that has this. This is just one of his songs. One of his songs. Now, so we're into liberal psychosis here, right? So Portland, Oregon is now having endless nights of riots and Antifa and psychotic horse crap because they made the mistake of allowing Oregon to be controlled by a communist. Portland mayor is a communist. Well, during one of the riots, numerous ones, one police officer doing what police officers do to rioters, he had his baton and he smacked these people and told them to get out and go away. Well, he got charged. He got charged for assault and abuse. And in turn, the complete riot team in Portland resigned. 50 men. This has to happen nationwide. And not wait for somebody to be made a scapegoat. The police departments nationwide need to resign. This is the problem with humans. If they don't have their face rubbed in it bad enough, they're not going to think there's a problem because it hasn't affected them directly. And that's the best bet, is to rub their faces in this criminality and psychosis really hard, and then see, oh God, we better get our police force back back in duty and fund them properly, and oh my God, we got to handle this. This is ridiculous, and it's not going to get any better because the psychosis of liberalism feeds itself. There's no ability for critical thinking in any way, shape, or form. So no matter how bad they are, in their minds, they're never the cause of something. Never a cause. And that's a, you know, that's a strange phenomenon. These people can fill their car with gas, and they know their car only goes 200 miles on a full tank of gas, and they will go 205 miles and run out of gas, and they will swear to God there's something wrong with the gas. The gas gauge is bad. The gas station ripped him off and didn't give him the full amount. They will find many different reasons for their problem other than the fact that they ran out of gas. And these are the woke people. These people are more smarter than the rest of us. My resident comedian has something to say about that.
Hi, welcome to the Science Channel. From an evolutionary perspective, woke people are the strongest, most capable form of hominoids history has ever seen. They're superior human beings. I'll explain what makes the woke apex predators on top of nature's food chain, but first, you have to understand, woke people didn't just appear overnight. In simple terms, evolution is what we do at a genetic level to win the competition of survival against other forms of life in nature. Now, evolution takes time, so to take a look at the woke's earliest human ancestors, we need to rewind the clock back about 10 years to the pre-paleo-wokolithic era. Back then, you had a primitive people known as Homo sapiens. These were a type of hominesses who survived using primitive skills such as strength, bravery, intelligence, and productivity. And interestingly, their species only had two genders. Then midway through this era, just after the world ended because of climate change, according to Al Gore, the Homo sapien developed into Homo sapien justicus, or commonly referred to as social justice warriors. They were the first pre-woke ancestors who originated online hatred. It's believed they understood fire, and they also learned how to make weapons out of keyboards, and they began mating primarily with their own hands while staring at computer screens. That led us to the current Paleo-Wokeolithic era that created the conditions for the Homo sapien non-binary woketicus to develop and thrive, or commonly referred to as the woke. They're a very advanced phylum of people who have evolved to shed what are now unnecessary prehistoric qualities like gills, large canines, and self-responsibility. And along with developing the ability to have an inability to tolerate even the slightest bit of discomfort, they've also evolved to develop 72 genders. Now, when we've studied the fossilized evidence of primitive people, we've discovered strong evidence that suggests they did all their thinking in their brains. Whereas the woke carry around additional brains in the form of devices like phones, tablets, and TVs, which is where all their thinking comes from. Now, let's not forget how the woke became the apex predators at the top of the food chain in the first place. Was it by outwitting, outsmarting, or being stronger than their competition? No, it's because they canceled all the predators that used to be above them. It's an advanced capability that no other species in nature has ever achieved. The former predators at the top of the food chain, like orca whales, lions, and gorillas, made the mistake of competing against other species by being better than them. Unlike the woke, their lack of adaptivity to become degenerates clearly led to their downfall from the top step of nature's podium. The woke have gotten to where they are not by judging people based on the content of their character, but by judging them based on their skin color and pronouns. They've evolved to have no character, so it simply doesn't matter to them. Darwin's theory of evolution is survival of the fittest. Yet to better understand the genetic development of the woke, our scientific analysis of stool droppings from Hollywood celebrities, along with carbon dating Molotov cocktail shrapnel from downtown Portland, has proven that what's more true than survival of the fittest is survival of the outraged. Whereas those who archaically lived peacefully, productively, and lovingly have simply died off because they weren't fit to survive. Now, the woke have a high degree of intellectual capacity for outrage, which makes them capable of even being offended by their own God-given genders. And where baboons speak a language of throwing feces at each other, the woke speak a language of virtue signaling at each other, and they thrive eating a diet primarily based in propaganda. When learning about the woke, it's best to think of evolution as a spectrum. Intelligence evolved into outrage, freedom evolved into obedience, love evolved into hate, and self-responsibility evolved into socialism. Studying ancient iterations of people reveals interesting hieroglyphic evidence that they worshipped a rather primitive interpretation of a non-human god, one that was all-loving in them and around them at all times, and to be trusted as the most important source of life guidance, whereas the woke have several gods in human form that they're very obedient to. The woke have advanced their genetic IQs to the point that they no longer base facts on truth. Now, this is an exciting intellectual advancement that previous hominous eras only could have imagined, and the advanced lack of activity in the cerebral cortex of the woke has allowed them to develop the ability to shapeshift objective reality, primarily by changing the definitions of words. Accordingly, staying locked in one's home for months at a time out of fear is an act of courage for the woke that would make the most courageous lion in the jungle look like a coward. We've found the now extinct primitive people had what's called a backbone, which is in part what led to their demise. But through genetic adaptation, the woke have replaced the backbone with conformity. The woke have an impressive ability to blame other people for virtually any problem they encounter, which allows them to quickly and easily overcome any obstacle. Their blame, along with their strong ability to victimize themselves over anything, are chief reasons why we think they've been able to evolve to be so advanced in such a short period of time. This has been just a brief glimpse into the fascinating evolutionary biology of the woke. Stay tuned for more scientific discoveries. We'll keep studying the woke until they make our planet uninhabitable.
And remember, Karl Marx said, start them young, get them in when they're children. There are at least 13 different kids shows out there right now that are pushing the pervert agenda. They call it the LGBTQ Q for queer agenda on children. This is big time. This is not lightweight. So you parents that say, oh, just go watch TV, leave us alone. She-Ra and the Princess of Power. SpongeBob SquarePants. Scooby-Doo Mystery Incorporated are pushing perversion. Lesbianism. DuckTales. My Little Pony. Arthur. See, these are the... people don't know this. Adventure Time on Cartoon Network. Andy Mack on the Disney Channel. So they have like 13-year-old perverts on there. The Loud House, Clarence, Steven Universe, Blue's Clues, Star versus the Forces of Evil. Oh, you don't even want to see the clip I'm looking at here. Yeah, so they have a school dance, and these two boys are kissing, and these two girls are kissing. And this is on children's cartoon networks. We really have to pay attention. The cost of freedom is eternal vigilance, and the key word is eternal, unfortunately. Now we're going to go into the government threat. Because the communist government... now, you all understand when I use the term communist, I'm talking about Democrats, okay? It's that simple. That's what they are. So the communist government right now, that's in control of the daycare center in Washington, D.C., is doing... not only are they doing nothing to protect the borders of the United States, they're actually tearing the borders down. So Arizona and Texas have both said, we're going to do our own border wall, and they're asking all the other states to send them law enforcement agents to help them at the border. This is real. When I was down in Texas, that's what I was hearing, was that they're just, the hell with it, we'll do it ourselves. Texas has the third largest economy in the world, not just in the United States. So they can do it themselves. They don't need to beg from a commie government. Which is pretty much what we got here right now. Okay, now you know the Chicago mayor. She looks kind of like a cross between Beetlejuice and a dung beetle. She is insane, but she's like and I use the term she loosely because I'm not sure if it's a she or he, or does it depend which way the wind's blowing? I don't know, but she has decided that racism is the one thing that's needed to be eradicated to improve community living. This is hard to understand, but she said that systemic racism is a leading factor in life expectancy discrepancies across the whole city. Well, she's right. This is in Chicago. She's right, because the blacks are busy killing each other. There's 25 to 100 people shot every weekend. And it's all by blacks. There's very few white people in there. There's very few white people in there, period. But there's very few white people shooting each other. It's the blacks, because they hate all humans, including themselves. But she's insane. She literally is pulling $10 million out of a budget. Well, she has that money to spend now because she's getting rid of all the police departments because they're racist. See, and that's... the white man is the thing that's causing the black guy to shoot each other, as far as I understand. Now, government threat, and I was part of this years ago. I don't know if you guys remember. Years ago, there was something called the Modesto flood. And my shop was just 100 yards from the line of water that was raised. The Modesto flood was caused because the Army Corps of Engineers and the people that control the water system in California are communists. So, in other words, they have no clue what the hell they're doing. So the Army Corps of Engineers was busy letting all the water out of some of the dams and then not letting water out of other dams. So everything backed up, flooded, and got destroyed. And that's what caused the Modesto flood. If you look up on the internet, Modesto flood, you'll see what I'm talking about. Well, they're doing the same thing now, and they're doing it on purpose, but a little bit different, so that they can declare a water shortage in California. They are dumping trillions of gallons of fresh water directly in the ocean instead of putting it into reservoirs. And then you see pictures of, like, Folsom Lake is the lowest it's ever been. And all these different reservoirs and lakes are real, real low. It's not magic. It's because the idiots that run California are letting the water out. Now, their job is to do that in case of possible heavy rainfall, right? So they want to prepare a location for the heavy rains to go to. But no, they're doing it now. They're doing it now. Now, let's see, more government threat. Now, the UN is not really a government, even though they want to be. But they have agencies under there. UNICEF, United Nations Children, that was the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund. That's what it used to be. That's what it was formed as, UNICEF, for children, to help children. UNICEF now is coming out and telling the whole world how to run their lives and how to raise their children. UNICEF says restricting children's porn access infringes human rights. Huh? It's a 2020 EU study from 19 European Union countries. And UNICEF has decided, here's some of the criteria for this study. Does looking at porn make the children upset or happy? Well, it makes them happy. You know, I don't know about you, but if I was 16 years old and somebody said, here, I want you to look at this porn and it's totally okay, I'd be happy too. But this is what's happening. And UNICEF is releasing this report worldwide just days after the U.S. Agency for International Development announced its renewal of its partnership with UNICEF, giving an extra $300 million in direct program funding. Extra, I said, okay? Additional. They're already given a total of $994 million for UNICEF to help children. This is helping children. Speaking of insanity, see, this is the problem. What do I put this under? Government threat, liberal psychosis, same thing. The IRS has denied tax-exempt status to a church, organization within this church. Because what they do is they pray for both Democrats and Republicans. This is the problem. They pray for both the Republican and the Democrat Party. This is literally what they do. It's a Texas group that encourages church members to pray for state and national leaders regardless of their party affiliation because it benefits everyone. The IRS says you do not qualify as an organization described in IRS Section 501c3. You engage in prohibited political campaign intervention. God's intervening, obviously. And it's because you are also not operated exclusively for one or more exempt purposes within the meaning of Section 501c3 because you operate for a substantial non-exempt private purpose and for the private interests of the Republican Party. In other words, the Republicans are the only ones that actually care about God or religion, whereas the Democrats don't give a damn. Most of them are atheists or pretend that they're religious. This is what the IRS is saying. Because Republicans are religious, this would give more benefit to them. On one hand, it's granting credence to God, I guess. Now, this is still under the government threat. The FBI and the Department of Homeland Services have been trying to recruit what you would call CIs, confidential informants. This is known. This is nothing special. This is nothing out of the blue. They've always done it. The FBI is part of the dark state. They have their own agenda. It doesn't matter who's running the country. They'll do what they want to do. And their agenda, when you first look at it, is that of Mao Zedong. It's how communists take over a country. One of the ways they do it is by creating a whole cadre of confidential informants, CIs. And this one article is talking about how FBI and the DHS agents went to this Green Beret, ex-Green Beret, and wanted him to infiltrate Oath Keepers. They've done the same thing to me. They've done it numerous times. But yes, this is what they do. And they go to people who have certain abilities, and they'll say, we want you to help us try and set people up. Do you know, almost every false flag, if you want to call it that, almost every major heinous crime, 9/11, the Oklahoma bombing, there's 50 or 60 examples. The FBI was instrumental in committing these crimes. The FBI, well, some years back, before they actually blew up and destroyed the towers, the FBI got a group of Arabs, and there were four of them. So one of their agents infiltrated the group, talked them into blowing up a building, basically rented a U-Haul truck, built the bombs that went in the back of the U-Haul truck, drove the truck to the basement, the parking garage in that building, and set the timer. The FBI did all of this. And it just took out a few cars, and it was not powerful enough to do much damage. But it turned out afterwards it was the FBI. The FBI does all of this. The January 6th organizers were working for the FBI. A lot of these Antifa members aren't real Antifa. They're working for the FBI. And they're not trying to infiltrate Antifa to find out who the bigwigs are so they can arrest them. No, they're trying to get Antifa members to destroy things, blow things up, and kill people so that they can start a war. This is what they do. Usually it's done some foreign nation like Serbia or Cuba or South America or Grenada. But they've been doing it in the United States now for the past 30, 40 years. And yes, it's not going to get better. There is no question about that in any way, shape, or form. Every president since the end of World War II, on the day of the Normandy invasion, they have had a little saying, or they've commemorated D-Day. Well, Dimwit didn't at all. He just totally snubbed it, ignored it. But that didn't stop his black, racist, perverted, I don't know what you want to call this piece of crap, his Secretary of Defense. The Secretary of Defense praised the pervert community for winning historic conflicts, including the Civil War. It took perverts to win the Civil War. Basically, that's what he said. This is disgusting. Our military is a laughing stock of the world. Totally 100% laughing stock of the world. As a matter of fact, all military are being forced to study this critical race theory crap. And in fact, the Secretary of Defense was asked a few questions last week.
Mr. Secretary, I received, along with Congressman Crenshaw, several hundred whistleblower complaints about Pentagon extremist and diversity training. I want to share just a small selection of what your own troops are saying. And Mr. Chairman, I have a longer list that I'd like to submit for the record.
Without objection.
Again, this is just a few examples. One Marine told us that a military history training session was replaced with mandatory training on police brutality, white privilege, and systemic racism. He reported that several officers are now leaving his unit, citing that training. Another service member told us that their unit was required to read White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo, which claims, and this is a quote, white people raised in Western society are conditioned into a white supremacist worldview. A member of the special operations community has told us that they are being instructed that, quote, the U.S. special operations community is racist. One Army officer relayed to us the words of his general officer, who told him that the entire U.S. Army is racist. A midshipman at the Naval Academy said classmates are calling America a fundamentally racist place and that this sentiment is not contested by school administrators. An airman told us their unit was forced into a racist exercise called a privilege walk, where members of the wing were ordered to separate themselves by race and gender in order to stratify people based on their perceived privilege. One African-American officer disparagingly said, and I quote, the Navy thinks my only value is as a black woman. and not the fact that she is a highly trained military specialist. Soldiers have come forward to tell us they are being forced to watch videos about systemic racism and documentaries that rewrite America's history as a fundamentally racist and evil nation. One Space Force officer told me that two Guardians left his ranks in a short period of time. One was a young African-American who said that after the training, she would never have joined the military had she known that it was such a hotbed of racism. The other was a white airman who said he didn't sign up to be indoctrinated and filed separation paperwork. Mr. Secretary, we're hearing reports of plummeting morale, growing mistrust between the races and sexes where none existed just 6 months ago, and unexpected retirements and separations based on these trainings alone. And again, these are not my words. These are the words of your own troops. So I want to ask a few simple but vital questions. Mr. Secretary, do you believe that our military is a fundamentally racist organization? Yes or no, please.
Well, I won't give you a yes or no answer on that, Senator, because it deserves more than a yes or no. The military, like any organization, will have its challenges, but I do not believe it is a fundamentally racist organization.
Thank you. I'm sorry to cut you off, but our time is limited. I think it is a pretty simple question. I'm glad that you agree it is not fundamentally racist. Do you believe that any member of the military should be treated differently based on their skin color and sex? Again, yes or no will do.
Again, this question deserves more than a yes or no answer.
Mr. Secretary, I'm sorry to cut you off. Our time is limited. It is a very simple question. Should a member of the organization you lead be treated differently, in violation of the Constitution, I would add, based on their sex or the color of their skin?
No, I do not believe that, and that is why we have diversity, equity, and inclusion focused in the military.
Military shouldn't be focused on the social warrior crap. They should be focused on killing people and breaking things. That's what their job is. And people like me who say these kind of things are the enemy of this government, not because I come out and say it, but because they have. Dimwit has decided that he's going to be taking very, very powerful steps against white supremacists and militias. This is getting too far out of hand. And when I've told you before, when the crap happens, it's going to happen fast. They are doing so much right now, and by they I mean the communists in charge of the United States. They are coming out and they're using terms like domestic terrorists, whole society approach. They're coming after the white man, the Christians, and anyone in any way, shape, or form who dares dissent against the full control of this communist push that we're being hit with. You guys, any of you out there who say, yeah, I have friends that are Democrats, they're fine, they're okay, they're just, you know, don't confuse politics with reality. Yeah, well, that's stupid. Let me tell you something. Politics is nothing more than an extension of your personal ethics, morals, and philosophy. That's what politics are. So if you are a scum, if you want to destroy the United States, if you hate white people, if you hate firearms, if you hate anything that has to do with America, you're a Democrat. And that's how it works. It's that damn simple. In fact, Dimwit has also come out and said that we know that everybody out there wants to be a good citizen. So if you have any friends or if any of your family members have become radicalized, what is radicalized? That's somebody who says, what the hell is this government doing? They're stealing everybody's property, all their money. They want to ban firearms. Okay, that's a radicalized person. They want you to start turning them in. As a matter of fact, all the schools in the United States, all of the colleges in the United States, all of the corporations, the big corporations in the United States, they all are going to have anonymous networks set up to where you can turn in that radicalized friend of yours or your radicalized mother or father or brother. This is communist China. It's almost a mirror with a bit more and better technological changes that have occurred. I have a copy of the National Strategy for Countering Domestic Terrorism. It's a PDF. You're going to want to read it. I'm going to be posting it on the website. It'll be under show notes. And it talks, you won't believe this. They talk about all these mass shootings. You know something? All these mass shootings, it's, how do they put it? 90% is blacks. 90% are blacks that do mass shooting in the United States. In other countries, it's different. But this is what's going to be happening. I'm going to have this posted. You're going to need to read this thing. I'm not going to go through it and read it because I just, it would just piss me off too much to do so. Dimwit has figured out the best way, and this is the opening stanza for the gun confiscation order legislation. This is how it's going to work. The court, and here's a part of it, okay? Court shall issue an emergency ex parte, meaning nobody's there, the defendant's not there, extreme risk protection order upon submission of an application by a petitioner, which means by any government agency, supported by an affidavit or sworn oral statement of the petitioner, or other witnesses, that provide specific facts establishing probable cause that the respondent's possession or receipt of a firearm will pose a significant danger, extreme risk, or other appropriate standard established by state law problems of personal injury or death to the respondent or another person. In other words, and they can do this not just for a person, but a category. A category. This is how widespread this is. They can create a probable cause for confiscation of firearms from all white people or all military personnel that are white or all white preachers. And they will. And this is going to be pushed through. This is... the whole thing's here. You can read it. This is astounding. I'm not bored. You know, I'm sitting here watching the United States turn into a communist country. At least I'm not bored. And they're bringing in hundreds of thousands of these unregistered Democrat voters. These children. This is another thing that he's doing. It's known as family reunification. Okay, so when Trump was in charge, and remember, the Democrats look at children as anyone 25 or under, okay? These children show up in the United States without their parents. So the Border Patrol would try and find their parents back in Mexico or Guatemala or wherever. Now, in this communist regime that's taken over, every child, every criminal alien that makes it to this border, that makes it into the United States, if they're 25 or under, their parents, wherever they are, will be reunified with them. I don't know if you remember the article in the newspaper where three of these coyotes took these three little girls, and they're like 2 and 3 years old, and literally dropped them over the border wall. What good would that do? Well, I'll tell you what good it did. Their parents and their uncles and aunts are now coming to America. It's called family reunification. And any illegals that are here, older, that say, my children are still in Mexico, they're going to reunify them. Bring the children over to the United States. You're not hearing any of this stuff. A little bit up here and there. But the majority of this information, people just are not getting. But the government, see, I get information from the Department of Homeland Security on a daily basis. They don't know who I am, so they send me all of these briefings. And I'm reading this stuff. Used to be you had to read between the lines to realize how communistic this crap was. Now they're right out in your face. And they're blaming Trump and everybody who ever voted for him, in other words, all Republicans, for any of these problems. See, they create this problem. It doesn't really exist. And then they create a solution, which is called family reunification. So they're bringing in, within the next year, there will be 250,000 more criminal aliens within the United States. It's disgusting. Now we're going to get in the category called, for now I just call it commie racism. And it's turned out that the majority of this racism thing is all blacks. Or extremely psychotic liberal whites. Remember that lady, the mother, that stood up before the New York Board of Education and was chewing them up one side down the other? She was interviewed. And this is about the critical race theory crap that they're pushing on everybody. She was interviewed after that, and you have to hear her. She is what we all need to be doing.
A New York mother takes her school board to task for pushing critical race theory. Take a look.
Stop indoctrinating our children. You're teaching my children and other children that if they believe in God Almighty, they're part of a cult. Why can't we let the public know that you're teaching our children to go out and murder our police officers? Do you want the proof? I have the proof. You work for me. I don't work for you. This is still America, ma'am. And as long as I'm standing here on this good ground earth of God, I will fight.
Tatiana Ibrahim joins us now. Good morning, Tatiana.
Good morning.
So obviously you're fed up. What took you to this point where you wanted to fight so hard?
When I started seeing the changes in my daughter, when I started hearing the changes in other children around her, the talk and the questions of why are cops killing innocent people? Why don't we like black people? Why don't blacks like us? Why are all these riots happening all over? What have we done to do this, to have caused all this? And the negativity, the lies that they have spoken about our former president. I say COVID was devastating. The only thing I can say, COVID brought out more parents to actually see what their children were learning online. And I was one of those parents. I was paying more attention. I was watching and listening. I was going through the curriculums. I was just listening to what other children were saying. And it was terrifying, terrifying of what's happening out there. People won't believe it unless they're seeing it. And we have to open our eyes because it's very terrifying.
You said they're teaching your children that police are bad. You say the majority of your district of police officers' children who back the blue. Give me some examples.
So one book in particular, it's called One Crazy Summer. It's being taught to our 7th and 8th graders in the middle school at George Fisher Middle School. This book specifically was picked up by the two that I had mentioned, Mr. Barry and Ms. Cyrus, created for their own curriculum. This book specifically states calling our police officers by the Black Panthers white racist cop pigs. Mm-hmm. In the book, it describes they're glorifying the Black Panthers, revolutionists. They're glorifying these cop killers, these murderers, as saviors to the Black community, when in fact, we all know, if we know our history, that they were anything but that. And they're not explaining to the children. So they're just giving it a one-sided story. And the author was invited into the schools on Zoom, via Zoom, to speak to the children.
Wow.
And she herself is known on Twitter for bashing police officers and whites.
I know one of the ladies on the board, she said she's a volunteer, that she doesn't get paid. She said, I want this to stop because I want to have a peaceful conversation. You said, I feel like I am being peaceful. You said one of the teachers criticized your daughter for being too pasty white. And you said, if you disagree with the teachers, then you're homophobic, you're racist, and you're part of a cult. Are you seeing any changes?
I'm seeing more parents stepping up. I'm seeing children more united. My daughter just came home and told me one of her girlfriends, she had a lot of positive feedback from her friends and their parents. And my daughter was shocked. And what really scared me was when I asked her, why are you shocked that your friend agrees with us? She says, because mommy, she's black. So what does that tell you? That you're making our children believe that because of a person's skin color, they can't have their own thoughts. Mm-hmm. They can't succeed. They can't achieve. They're the racist. Mm-hmm. They're defining people by color and keeping them down and not allowing people to thrive in life in this great land of ours.
That's right. We're all Americans.
Amazing country.
All right, Tatiana, we've got to leave it there. Thank you so much for coming on.
All right, now we're done with the BS. Let's get to the meat and potatoes. What we're going to be talking about now is pots and pans, specifically cast iron, carbon steel, and stainless steel, like the Revereware that most of you are used to. So we're going to talk about all this stuff. And I like talking about cast iron. cast iron pans, pots, and other equipment have been around as long as the United States have been here, and about 5,000 years before that. In archaeological digs, they have found pans, cast iron plates, which they used to use to cook breads on. And in China, thousands of years ago, cast iron cookware was handed down throughout the different dynasties. It was astounding how long this stuff lasts. My cast iron now came from my grandmother. So you need to learn how to take care of it. But I want you to hear a quick little story on the oldest cast iron company on earth.
When coal was king and iron was the South's gold, South Pittsburgh, Tennessee was in its heyday. Young men flocked to the Pittsburgh of the South to seek their fortune. One of those men was Joseph Lodge.
According to the legend, Joe Lodge walked from Chattanooga to South Pittsburgh, found work in this area with Tennessee Coal and Iron Company at a blast furnace. After working there for a while, he started his own foundry, originally Blacklock Foundry, to make cast iron cookware. In 1910, the foundry burned down. And when he rebuilt the foundry on the south end of town, he renamed it Lodge Manufacturing.
And today, over 115 years later, the company has survived as the only manufacturer of cast iron cookware in America. As fads come and go and products are developed, from Teflon to ionized surfaces, cast iron and the name Lodge have endured for more than four generations of cooks.
There have been some hard times, as most businesses encounter, but I think that the basic nature of cast iron and the multi-uses, you know, you can cook almost anything any way you want to cook it in cast iron. And so it's such a versatile kitchen piece that we have managed to really thrive in a lot of cases where other cookwares have struggled a little bit.
Through the years, an endless stockpile of products have been developed and produced at a foundry that remains relatively unchanged, except for a few technological advances. It all begins here, in this pile of co-mingled metals, pig iron, steel, and Lodge's own recycled castings. It takes 10 pounds of poured metal to make 1 5-pound skillet. 200 workers man 2 10-hour shifts, 4 days a week.
From the minute the metal's poured till packing is 90 minutes. On an average, we make 400 pieces of cast iron cookware an hour. That's with two lines. And sometimes, if all the cast iron gods align, we can make up to 1,600 pieces an hour.
The metal is melted at 2,800 degrees. Impurities, known as slag, float to the top. The slag is then skimmed off, and the molten metal is tested every 30 minutes for 19 different things, specifically to ensure that heavy metals are not present. From the melting deck, the liquid metal is transported to this huge machine known as the Dezimatic. At a constant 2,500 degrees, smoldering iron shoots into sandcast molds.
What we've been able to do is automate a century-old process. To give you an example, back in the day when we hand-poured cast iron, a good person could make 200 molds in a 10-hour shift. Today, we can make 400 molds an hour.
A constant temperature of 2,500 degrees ensures a consistency to the cookware, eliminating white swirls and gray creases that produce imbalanced heat retention for the consumer. As the ironware breaks out of the molds, all of the debris crumbles onto conveyor belts. A shaking machine removes sand, which will be recycled. Quality control looks at the skillet. A few have rough edges, and a grinder's used to make them smooth. Stainless steel pebbles add more smoothness to the surface, and a thorough washing gets the pans ready for a process that has brought cast iron cookware into the 21st century.
Well, we realized as the years went by that the two big drawbacks of cast iron were, one, that it's heavy, which is also an advantage from a cooking perspective, but also that seasoning was an issue, having to season that raw iron. So back in 2000, we started realizing that we needed to develop a process to be able to season the skillets.
A soy-based vegetable oil coats the cast iron with an electrostatic system that ensures the oil will adhere to the cookware. After the spraying, it's baked at a very high temperature, turning the gray metal into a black patina. As newer generations buy cast iron, they're discovering its versatility.
Careful you don't burn your mouth on this one, because you're going to want to eat this right out of the pan.
And the demand is being fueled by television.
There's been a renaissance, in a sense, with a younger group of people driven by the 24-hour food network shows cooking shows are popular. Cooking is popular. That's what's really caused the resurgence of cast iron and the realization by the public that it's such a versatile and wonderful piece to have in the kitchen.
And what would Joseph Lodge say to his great-grandson if he could see what has happened to his company he started in 1896?
I think he'd just say, wow. I don't see how it could not have exceeded all his expectations for longevity, for product quality, the range of products that we offer. I think he'd be amazed.
Now, there's a lot of different companies now making cast iron pans, and some of them are Wagner, Griswold. There's a whole bunch more, especially out of EU. Some of these companies are no longer in existence, but some of them, they're not cheap. You can go to Costco, and you can buy a set, a three-pan set of Lodge cast iron cookware, and it's, I don't know what it is, it's under $50. But these things will last indefinitely if you know how to take care of them. And here's the problem is that people don't know how to take care of them. I make some hellacious scores when I go to yard sales. Now, there's a lot of Chinese copies. And these Chinese cast iron pans, they look almost like a real cast iron pan, except they're like half the dimension. They're half thickness. And you've got to be careful. Chinese are not well known for quality. Some of these things can burst. They can break. They can fracture. Lodge, I've never had one fracture. And I've used cast iron pan since I was like 5 years old, unless you drop them. But usually when you drop a cast iron pan, your foot seems to magically stop it from hitting the floor. Yeah, you got to be careful about that. So to give you an idea, I go to a yard sale, and here's a 12-inch cast iron Lodge pan. It's got about a quarter inch, and I'm not exaggerating, of goo and crap and carbon, not just inside of it, outside of it. Oh yeah, this was our camping frying pan. Even the lid had crap on it, and it's baked in, and that's the problem. Now, those things, that pan right there, you can go to Walmart and buy it, is probably a little under $30. So I gave the guy the dollar he was asking, because he'd been trying to sell it for years, and nobody'd buy it. And I took it home. Now, I put it in a pile with the rest of the crap that I had bought from various yard sales. You want to strip. If you're buying a new, it's different. We're talking used here. So you're going to want to clean this thing, and you're going to want to strip off all the crap, and then you're going to want to season it so that you can use it for yourself. So here's what I do. Depending on the severity of the glop that's on it, usually I'll take it, and this is the only time you use soap. I use hot soap and water and a steel spatula. And I soap it up good, let it soak for a little bit, and then I scrape it with the spatula. I get as much of the crap off as I can. And you're not going to get it all. I don't care how what you use, even if you use an axe. So you clean it up as best you can. And then what you do, now, if you have an electric stove, you're going to have a self-cleaning section on it. That's what you want to use. You put a, you're going to be putting a, like a pie pan, or you're going to line the bottom of it, of the oven, with aluminum foil or something. Be careful. You don't want to short out the burners, because all that crap is going to go somewhere, and it usually goes down. So I took all of these pans. I had a bunch of pans. I had a couple cast iron Dutch ovens, and I had a 12-inch and a 10-inch and a 7-inch Lodge. I turned them all upside down and set them in there. Close the door, put it on self-cleaning. That runs for about an hour, and then it's going to take about an hour to cool down. But when you open that door, now you have to move quickly. When you open that door, the cast iron is going to look silver, because you've burned everything off, and now you're to the raw metal itself. You have to scrub the residue off. That you do with hot soap and water, okay? Hot soap and water, and you have to move fast. The instant you hit that with water, it's going to start rusting. So you hot soap and water, and then you rinse it in hot water, as hot as possible. And the reason is that heat is going to cause the cast iron to dry out fast. So then you've done this, right? You've cleaned this. You've hit it with the hot water. You have some vegetable oil and a paper towel or a rag handy right now, because now you're going to season it. People use different oils. My grandmother used to use a mixture of bacon and bear grease. Sometimes deer grease, any critter grease, any kind of oils or lard that you can get is going to help with this. What you're going to be doing is you're going to be cooking in the fats into the pores of the cast iron, which is going to give it its seasoning so that it can be almost nonstick. So you coat this thing down inside and out, handle, the bottom, the top, everything. put it back in. So you pulled the still kind of warm cast iron out. It's silver now. You've washed it, you've dried it, and you've coated it down with anything from canola oil to avocado oil to corn oil or whatever you want. It doesn't matter. Take big hands full of lard. Grandma used to take, she didn't have a stove. What she used to do was take the cast iron once every few years and build this fire about 3 foot in diameter in the backyard. And when it got down to the coals, she'd stick the pan in and let it sit there. And it would burn everything off. And then she'd take a wire brush and clean it out. And then she'd pack that thing with lard. Like I said, anything she can get her hands on. I mean, pack it. And then stick it back in there for a few hours. And then pull it out, pour everything out on the ground and wipe it out. Let it cool, wipe it out. And then it's seasoned. And it's kind of rough, you know. You look at that, and nowadays people go, oh my God, I'm going to get some dirt in my mouth if I use that. Yeah, well, that's good for you. That's the thing about iron. You need it. People need iron in their system nowadays, and they're not getting it. And this gives it to you. So now we're back to you, and you got these pans. You lubed them up really good. You shove them in the oven. You put the oven at about 350 degrees for 1 hour. That's it. 350 degrees, 1 hour. Now you're going to want to turn these upside down again. What happens is, as you heat this up, it's going to soak in. The grease, the lard, whatever you're using, is going to soak into the cast iron. And sometimes you get a little weird buildup in one little piece, one little part, one little edge. So if that doesn't bother you, don't worry about it. It's going to melt off anyway as soon as you cook with it. Put them back in the oven, 350 degrees for an hour. So if you have a self-cleaning oven, this is how you do it. Now, the other ways that I've done it is very simple. I buy cast iron that's crapped out, and I take it and I sandblast it. Cleans it perfectly. All right? So there's different ways to do it. You don't really want to use abrasion. You don't want to take a wire brush to clean it. You can do that if you want. And there has been some cast iron that I've used. The inside is so rough that I put a little wire brush grinder on my drill, and I polished the inside of it just to get the roughness out. Some of these cast iron pans will blow your mind. Some of them are smooth as glass. They're that old. I've had some Griswold that were that way. They literally were like as smooth as glass. Okay, now that you've got them seasoned, you wipe them down and you put them away wherever you're going to put them. Always remember this. These things got oil on them. These things got grease on them. Whatever you put on them, they're on them. So if you put these in a cupboard somewhere, they're going to get some grease on that on the shelf. That's why chefs usually hang all of this stuff. And if you do, remember, the grease is going to drip off and it's going to get down on the floor area. You got to be careful. Use some common sense. This is the ridiculous thing. Use some common sense. So cast iron holds heat a long time. I was making some tortillas, and the guy in the recording said, you'd be surprised of all the different applications we have for lodge cookware. Well, they make a tortilla pan, and it's about 12 inches in diameter, and it's simple. You can buy those anywhere. Walmart sells them. Put them on. If you have an electric oven, you're going to put them on about a number 4. You don't want to get these things real hot. You'll burn your tortillas. These heat up slow and hold the heat in. Sometimes if you're cooking, like you put it on and you turn your burner on to like a 6 or 7 or even a high, after about 10 seconds, you got to turn it down because it'll heat up. And that heat has a time lag from when it hits the cast iron to where it spreads out. So if you're not paying attention and you're using too much heat, it's going to show up in that pan. Now, the plus point about cast iron is you can cook on it on the stovetop at 300 degrees and shove it in the oven at 500 degrees. You're not going to hurt it. You're going to hurt your hand if you're not careful. That's why you've got to use pads when you're handling cast iron, because it all gets hot, not just some of it. Now, the seasoning is going to stay on your pan, and slowly over time it'll build up. Let's say that you decide to cook a couple steaks. Fine, you do all your cooking, you put your oil in the pan, you treat it just like any other pan, you season seasonings and your steak, and you're all done. Dinner's over. Now you're going to wash it. No soap. As little abrasion as possible. I use a nylon brush and hot water, and that's it. So I don't want to strip off the seasoning that's on there. I want to add to it. So let's say we cook the steaks and I use my 12-inch pan. Okay, so I get it under hot as water as I can handle, and I scrub it down with that brush. And if I have some rough spots on it, I'll use my fingernails. I'm not proud. I don't really want to get a steel spatula in there and start scraping, because you're going to be taking off the seasoning that's on there. So any rough spots, I just scrape them with my thumbnail and then brush them down again. Okay, so now you've washed this thing. Now you take a rag or paper towel. How I do it is this. I put it on the burner of the stove. I turn the burner on to high for 5 seconds. That's it. And then I turn it off. And I have a paper towel that's soaked with whatever oil we're going to be using. Usually I use extra virgin olive oil. And I put a liberal coating on the inside of the pan. I don't worry about the outside anymore. You only season the outside once. And then I put a liberal coating of this on the pan. The burner had heated up just a hair to where the cast iron was really absorbing the oil. So I put it on there, let it sit, and after about a half hour, I put it in the cupboard. And now I'm going to have, on the website, armchairsurvivalist.com, under show notes, I'm going to have a whole bunch of notes for this show. I have been not putting up all my show notes because, well, I've been gone. And I was gone for 2 weeks. I had a lot of crap I had to catch up on. So the past few shows, I have not even put the show notes up. I'm sorry about that. But that's of no importance to me because I'm not making any money off of that. But my son is going to help me. He's going to help me get all of this stuff up. Now, I have a whole bunch of recipes for cast iron. Cast iron cooks a little bit different than other pans because it holds its heat. I was making tortillas one time with my tortilla pan. Lights flickered, and I knew power was going out. So I turned on my little rechargeable light that I had right there next to the stove, and I just continued cooking, and powers went out. But I tell you what, that pan is just as hot as it was a few minutes ago. I cooked for another 5 to 8 minutes, and that pan was still hot enough to cook some more tortillas if I wanted to. So they will last. And the smart chef will turn off the burner while he's cooking before he needs to, because cast iron is going to hold heat. My dad knew more about this than I did. And after he died, I went to visit my sister in Hawaii and my stepmother there. And we were cooking in that. That's all they use in Hawaii. That's what all they use was cast iron. So I'm cooking some eggs. And I cook them, and then I take them out, and I put them on my plate, and they both started yelling at me because I left the damn burner on there. I said, you should have turned that burner off 5 minutes ago. You don't need to waste the energy. And I didn't say anything because I knew they were right. All right, there's a lot you can do with cast iron. There's a lot you can cook with it. You can sear meat phenomenally. And then you have the Dutch ovens. These are cast iron. These are the oldest cast iron. This is the pot. This is the pot. And there's two types of Dutch ovens. A Dutch oven can be anywhere from 8 inches in diameter to 12 inches to even bigger. And they have a cast iron lid. Now, the lid has a lip all the way around it. And the purpose of this was designed hundreds of years ago. There's two designs for Dutch ovens. One has three legs, and their legs are usually about 2 inches to 4 inches long, so that when you stand it and you set it down, it's about 3 to 4 inches off the ground. And the purpose of that is for cooking in a hearth or on a hearth in a fireplace. Keep it above the coals. The other one has no feet on it at all. It's just flat. And that one is for cooking on a stove. That one was designed in the late 1800s. But that's the two different ones. So remember, that's the reason one has legs, one doesn't. But that lip I was telling you about, on the top. The purpose of that lip is to hold the coals. Now, we used to, when we open in day of fishing season, we always go up, and we had a Dutch oven with a, you know, the old style Dutch oven with the lips on it. And what we would do is those instant biscuits. You know, you unwrap them and you hit them and they pop open. Well, all we do is we take a pat of butter. Now, we get the Dutch oven a little hot. Take a pat of butter and put it around the bottom and just wipe it around with our fingers. And then we start putting those biscuits in. And you can do more than one layer. And then you put the lid on, and then you take coals out of the fire and you put them on that lid. That's what that lip is for, is to keep the coals from falling off. And then literally you just pull that Dutch oven a little bit out so it's on the edge of the fire and let it sit. Those biscuits will be perfectly golden by the time you're ready to eat. It doesn't take that long. And we used to take the trout that we catch, rub them down with butter, put some lemon in the cleaned out gut area, wrap them in aluminum foil, stick them in the Dutch oven. I mean, it's almost like making tamales. You can fill it up to the top and do the same thing. And they cook beautifully. It was excellent. It was excellent. I haven't had trout like that since my son was a baby. And that's a long time ago. All right, now, I know there's a lot more to talk about on cast iron, but now we're going to talk about carbon steel. This, and that Lodge makes carbon steel pans as well. Carbon steel is, when you look at it, it just looks like 10-gauge steel with a handle on it. I mean, that's all it is steel. They're designed to hold heat and get hot fast, a lot faster than cast iron. All chefs use these. In all restaurants, you're going to find carbon steel pans. You can buy those at Walmart as well. Sometimes Costco has them. You season them the same way as you do cast iron. And I never use abrasives like Ajax or Comet or soap even on carbon steel. And we have two sets of actually three sets of cookware at home. We have cast iron, we have carbon steel, and we have the Revereware, the stainless steel copper bottom. Now the carbon steel, I've never seen any at a yard sale because in America people don't even know what the hell it is. They just don't know. But I can tell you this, it's literally, once you season them, literally, they're nonstick. It's astounding how well these things work, if you do it right. And if you don't do it right, if it doesn't become nonstick, wash it hot soap and water and start from scratch. And these are different. You don't have to put them in a self-cleaning oven. If they're really dirty, then you can just clean them. You can use abrasives, you use whatever you want. There is a chemical that you can buy. It's called Carbon Off, and its purpose is to remove carbon. And once you get, let's say you're a sloppy cook and you get grease and crap over the edge, and even on cast iron or carbon steel, doesn't matter, and then you cook it in, it's solid as a rock. So this Carbon Off actually will remove it. You got to do it outside, and it works as well on cast iron as it does on carbon steel and Revereware, stainless steelware. Whether it's Revereware or not, it works perfect on stainless steel. Because stainless steel, stainless steel is not rustless steel. It's stainless, meaning it withstands a lot of discoloration. But no discounting for idiots and lazy people. Boy, I tell you something, sometimes people can really screw up a good pan. Carbon Off, you coat it on. Now, whatever you use to coat it with, I use these cheap little pencil brushes because you're throwing it away, the brush. You put it on, you wash as best you can, then you coat all the black carbon spots with this, and you let it sit for about a half hour. Then you bring it inside and you do a little bit more washing. You're not going to get it all off at once. You're going to have to do two or three or four times. You coat it up, let it sit. Some of these things were coated so bad with carbon that I coated it up good, let it sit overnight. And then I let it sit in the sun. That got it hot. And that's the thing. If you can get them hot, Carbon Off works a lot better. Here's a little clip on carbon steel cook pans.
Even if you've never heard of a carbon steel skillet, you've almost certainly eaten food made in one. Restaurant chefs use carbon steel for everything from searing steak to sautéing onions to cooking eggs. French omelet and crepe pans are made of carbon steel, and so are Chinese woks. In European home kitchens, these pans are hugely popular, but somehow they've never really caught on with home cooks in the United States. But these pans have a reputation for being as great at browning as they are for keeping delicate foods from sticking. So we knew it was time to check them out. We bought 8 carbon steel skillets, all as close as possible to 12 inches, which is our preferred size for a primary skillet. Carbon steel pans are surprisingly inexpensive. Most of these cost just $40 to $80. But out of curiosity, we also included a $230 hand-forged pan made in Seattle. Now, we tried our carbon steel pans with a wide variety of recipes because they're supposed to be able to do it all. We fried eggs, we made cheese omelets, we pan-seared steak, and we even made the traditional French upside-down apple dessert called tarte tatin. This dessert begins on the stove with caramelizing apples and then moves to the oven to bake up the crust. Then you have to flip out this sticky, delicate dessert. Now, because these pans are made entirely of metal, they have no upper limits on their oven-safe temperatures, so you can use them in the oven anytime. Along the way, as always when we're testing skillets, we checked out their shape, their weight, their handle comfort, and how maneuverable they felt for a variety of testers. We washed the pans after every use to let us judge how easy they were to clean and maintain. Speaking of maintenance, the very first thing we learned about carbon steel is that, like cast iron, it rusts if the metal is bare. New pans have to be seasoned before you can start cooking. Seasoning just means bonding oil to the pan, which provides a layer of rust protection, but also starts the process of making the pan non-stick. This probably sounds a little more complicated than it actually was. In fact, two of our eight pans arrived pre-seasoned, but the other six needed us to get them started. Now, first you need to scrub off the shipping grease or wax that the manufacturers coat the pans with so they won't rust before you get them home. And then we followed each brand's recommendations for seasoning the pans. In the end, we found one simple method that our winner used. You just cook the peels of two potatoes in a ton of oil and salt. That's actually a third cup of oil and two-thirds cups of salt for about 8 to 10 minutes until they're nice and brown and crispy. And you move the peels around the pan to coat it well. And then you throw those peels out. You wipe out and rinse the pan. You dry it, and you're good to go. The peels seem to help soak up any remaining shipping grease or wax while the hot oil seasons the metal. Now, most of the pans, once we'd seasoned them, were amazingly nonstick after one round of seasoning. We saw fried eggs sliding around like a puck in air hockey. Omelets were rolling out in perfect golden oblongs, zero sticking. Tarts popped right out with very few exceptions, looking glossy and intact. And each time we cooked, more patina built up as the hot oil polymerized and bonded to the surface of the pans. The shiny silver surfaces of the new pans got more brown and blotchy, and that's a good thing. It means your pan is getting seasoned. Over a couple of months of cooking, the pan will keep darkening and getting more nonstick till it's almost solidly black or dark brown, and that's what you're working towards. And as a result, you never want to scrub with an abrasive or use soap on these pans, just like cast iron pans. Most of the time, we weren't even tempted to scrub because nothing stuck. We could practically just wipe them out with a paper towel after we were cooking. Otherwise, hot water, a gentle swish with a soft sponge, rinse, dry well with the towel and the stove's heat, and oil it lightly. That's all you need to do. Now, another benefit of carbon steel skillets, searing steaks and browning foods. A smoking hot traditional skillet does a perfectly acceptable job, and a cast iron skillet is brilliant at browning and searing, but we found the carbon steel pans trumped both of them. And we got impressively deep, even browning in the best carbon steel pans, easily on a par with cast iron. But carbon steel pans have another bonus. They're lighter and thinner, so they heat up in almost half the time as cast iron, and they're easier to lift and handle. The only drawback we could find was when we made skillet lasagna. The long simmering tomato sauce stripped off our seasoning, but we didn't notice any off flavors in the food, and the patina came right back after a couple of rounds of heating and wiping the pan with oil on the stovetop. A quick, short use of an acidic ingredient like a tomato-based pan sauce had no effect on the seasoning. Now finally, design features helped us single out our favorites. Some of these pans felt unbalanced or had slightly cramped cooking surfaces. Other ones had too high sides that made it awkward to get under food with a spatula, or so low that liquids kind of threatened to splash out. And several had unusually long, steeply angled handles that were a little bit awkward for shorter testers, and they barely fit in the oven when we made tarte tatin. Now, at the end of testing, we knew carbon steel skillets had earned a place in our kitchen, and we had two top choices. First, the Maître Bourgeat black steel round frying pan. It's just $44. This is a simple, classic pan that cooks beautifully. It's sturdy, it's easy to handle, smooth, and the inside is rivet-free so it doesn't trap any bits of food. If you have the money, the hand-forged pan is a stunner. It comes pre-seasoned, and it performed perfectly. It's called the Blue Skillet Ironware 13-inch fry pan for $230.
Yeah, I don't see me spending $230 in a frying pan, but I'll tell you, this carbon steel stuff, you can find them, get them, follow the instructions and use them. Now, Lodge and other companies, they manufacture both carbon steel and cast iron. and they, some of them are pre-treated, right? They're pre-seasoned for you. I am sorry. I don't care what comes out of somebody else's manufacturing plant. Even if it says pre-seasoned, it's going to get just a simple hot water rinse off, scrub off. Now, if it's not pre-seasoned, you're going to have to scrub it down and season it. Just follow the instructions. When you buy new, follow the instructions. The manufacturer always has instructions for it. But I don't trust pre-seasons. Too many bad things can happen. And according to Murphy's Law, they usually do. So, yeah, don't even waste my time with the pre-season stuff. I mean, it's nice to get it. I've seen them. I actually have been at the plant watching how they do this. And if you can imagine a conveyor belt with steel hooks on it, and these things are all the pots and pans and coffee pots and tortilla pans and everything you can imagine is hanging on these things, these hooks, going through this room. And through this room, they're spraying soy on it, soy oil, which is, I don't like that in the first place because all soy is genetically modified. But that's how they pre-season it. Now, it heats them in that room. And I don't remember what it heats them up to. I think it was like 250 to 300 degrees. And then they spray them. And that allows the metal to pull in the oils. And that's what they call pre-seasoned. All right, now we're going to talk about Revereware. And yes, Revereware is named after Paul Revere. He is the guy in 1802, he was 67 years old, he rolled the first copper sheets for supply to the U.S. government. And the idea behind the copper sheets was they would laminate them on different things, except like the frigate Constitution. There's worms that are in the water and they eat these wooden ships. So you coat the wood with copper and it the worms don't get into it. So this is where it started. It wasn't until 1802 when he first started. It wasn't until 1939 that the first Revereware pan was available for sale to the public. And the key behind it is this. Stainless steel is good, but it does not, as cookware, but does not transmit heat properly or evenly. You get hot spots all through a pot. But they discovered that if you take and laminate copper on the bottom of it, or in Revereware's, in the beginning, in 38 and 39, it was electroplated on, and it was fairly thick. It would absorb and transmit heat evenly. That's why Revereware is like gold. People get it, they keep it the rest of their lives. It's some of the best cookware you could ever get. There are ways to season that as well. And it almost, and this is surprising because you think stainless steel, well, you don't need to season that. Well, you do. You do. And I even have a trick to teach. I'm going to teach you how to cook with it so it's nonstick. Okay. Now, whenever I get Revereware, and in the past 10 years, I've had hundreds and hundreds of pieces of it. I wanted a complete collection, so I go to yard sales and I buy boxes and boxes of Revereware. These people, and they're all crudded up, right? High, they got carbon on them. They're crudded up. They look awful. These people don't, nobody knows how to take care of it. So I buy it, clean it up, and I keep the best ones to complete my set, and then I'd sell the rest of them. Now, a couple things with Revereware cleaning. Again, the carbon off. If you got a pot that's really bad, you use the carbon off to get the carbon off, obviously, duh. To clean the copper bottom, if it's really bad with carbon, then you're going to have to use the carbon off for that. But you don't want to use a lot of abrasive anything on the copper bottom of a Revereware because it's electroplated on and you can scrape it all off. It's not going to be easy, but I've seen it happen. Here is the secret to cleaning copper. This is handed down to me through my family, through my grandmother, who got it from the great-grandmother. See, this trick is used for copper, no matter what it is. We've always had copper pots, copper tea kettles, copper cups. Okay, all you use, you take a lemon, cut it in half, and salt. That's all you use. You wipe the copper down with the lemon, and then you sprinkle salt on as an abrasive. You take the lemon and you scrub it. You literally will make this copper look brand new. Sometimes, okay, that's one way to do it. Now, if it needs any abrasive, that's why I say the salt. So lemon and salt, okay? Or ketchup. Yep, ketchup. Ketchup is so acidic, it'll eat all of the oxidation off the off the copper. And if it's really bad, then you add salt again for the abrasive. So you get the cheapest ketchup you can, put it on the copper with your hand. Rub it down. Use your hand as a sponge and just rub everything down. Rub everything down. You're going to feel if there's any raised spots on the copper. You're like, oh, maybe there's some crud here that's going to have to use a little abrasive. Then you take a salt shaker and shake it on and then rub it some more. This will blow your mind. Now, here's the other thing you got to remember about ketchup and tomatoes. And he touched on it in the Lodge report. Or she touched on it in the carbon steel report. If you cook in carbon steel or cast iron using tomatoes, if it's a large meal and you're cooking it for a long time, it will eat off all the seasoning you have. Oh, it'll piss you right off. If you have a beautifully seasoned cast iron, deep cast iron 12-inch pan, and it's all black and it's perfect, you make yourself some lasagna in there or something, some ravioli or something that's a lot of tomatoes, when you go to clean that, you're going to find the inside almost white. You're just going to have to start over from scratch and season it again. So remember that. That's why I use stainless steel if we're going to use any of the do any of the tomato cooking, that kind of stuff. That's how you clean the Revereware. That's how you clean copper. Now, once you've cleaned it, you wash it out and all that good stuff. There is actual stainless steel polish that you can buy that will make it nice and pretty. Now, here is the secret to cooking in stainless steel. The problem is the heat. People don't know how hot it should get, so they start cooking when it's too cold or cool. Let's say you got a 12-inch stainless steel frying pan. You're going to cook some chicken breasts. You turn it on, and yeah, again, you're going to treat stainless steel the same way you're going to treat cast iron or anything else you're going to use other than that neurotoxin Teflon pans. Take a pad, little oil on it, and rub the whole everything. Everything you're rubbing. Just rub everything. Everything you're going to use, the sides, the bottom, the corners, everything. Okay. Now you let this thing cook. Now you wipe off the excess. All you're doing is putting a small, thin film of oil on. You turn your pan on. Now, obviously, again, you wiped out all of the excess of the oil. You turn the pan on, and you let it get hot. And then you always start in the middle, like around 4 if you're using electric. And if you're using gas, you want it below midway. And then you take a little cup of water, and I just use my fingers. And you take two fingers, and you just dip in the water, and you drop the water in the pan. If it sizzles and jumps all over and evaporates, believe it or not, you're too cold. Let it get hotter. What you want to have happen is they call the mercury ball. When I was a kid, we played with mercury before we were told it was toxic. So you take, finally, you're going to drop some water on there, and it's going to turn into a ball, and it can roll around there without evaporating, without spreading. It's just a little ball. Now, it could be a bigger ball. Depends how fat your hand is. But you drop some water on there, and when it's to the point where it's a ball, that's when you cook. Because what happens is the heat creates a pocket of air between the pan, the stainless steel, and whatever medium you're going to put in there. It's a pocket of air. It really is. And that's why the ball doesn't evaporate right away. Okay, at that exact point, you put in your oils you're going to cook with, and you want to try and keep this temperature, whatever it is. It could be 362 degrees, it could be 290 degrees, whatever it is, you're going to want to keep that temperature because that's the nonstick part. So I've done eggs the same way. Pouring a bunch of eggs, use a plastic spatula or silicone, whatever the hell it is, and you can move the eggs around, and you can see that they're not sticking. It's because you have it at that exact temperature. So it's the called the mercury ball test. Now, the key behind all cookware, I don't care if it's cast iron, carbon steel, or Revereware, is how you take care of it. If it's nothing more to you than a plate and a spoon, don't waste your time. Go find something cheap. You know, get yourself a $1.99 pan that's Teflon coated. Teflon is a neurotoxin. Teflon is one of the things on Earth that causes cancer. If you have a Teflon pan, it's fine as long as you don't overheat it, because it will off-gas Teflon, which is a neurotoxin, at high temperatures. If you have a Teflon pan of any kind, and just so you know, there is no non-stick pans, especially if they're aluminum with some coating on them, I don't care what that coating is, they're going to have PFOA or PTFE. They will have it. They are lying to you, and this is a fraud. You see, you go right into Costco, and you see these beautiful sets of pan cookware that have all these little raised ridges on the bottom and all of this crap, and a big sign on the front says, no PFOA. Well, I'm going to tell you this. Go to their website. Dig down. You will find where they tell you, oh, yeah, it's PTFE. It's just a different version of Teflon, and that's all it is. Every single one, the three types of cookware that I just talked about, are the only types of cookware you can use safely. Now, I had a Teflon pan. It wasn't Teflon, really. It was copper, it's copper-coated type thing on the inside. I don't care what they do or call it. It still has, they have PTFE or PFOAs in there. It's fine until there is a scratch or a nick. That exact moment, neurotoxins are leaching into your food. This is real. You want to do your own due diligence, you go right ahead. And that's why we cook with cast iron, carbon steel, and Revereware, stainless steel copper bottom. We have tried all kinds of other stainless steel cookware. None of them work right. None of them. That's why we stuck with the Revereware. Now, you got to be careful, because Revereware now is made in China. And the electroplating copper on the bottom is half the thickness as it used to be. So if you're going to buy new Revereware, realize that. You're going to have to modify how you cook with it all. And by the way, in the beginning, the handles on Revereware, because the pot always has two handles, one on each side, and then the lid has one handle on the top. They were made out of various different products, from plastics to Bakelite to all kinds of things. Those are removable and replaceable. And if you're buying a used set or some used Revereware, you can be careful when you do this so you don't break it. But you take the unscrew the lid, the handle from the lid, because it's probably crap loaded underneath of it. You're going to want to clean it well. And unscrew the side handles and take them off and clean them as well, too. Now, if you have some Revereware where the handles are chipped or broken and you want to replace them, go on eBay. This is why we use what we use in the Wilson household. And we have for back to my mom, back to my grandparents, my great-grandparents. So do yourself a favor and pay attention to what I said. And I will have all the links up, and you're going to find all kinds of different recipes. And there's so many recipes on the internet, it'll blow your mind, on cast iron cookware. That's it for today. I hope you guys are all paying attention to what's going on out there, because when the Schumer hits the fan, it's going to be faster than you think. It's going to be days. Most people say, oh, yeah, I still got time to prepare. I got time to go buy food and do this and do that. Are you paying attention? Are you getting the food ads each week and watching how prices are going up? Poultry prices went up at least 20% in the past 2 weeks. At least 20%. Where I could buy boneless, skinless chicken breasts at $1.29 to $1.40 a pound. It's now on sale for $1.80 a pound. And that's just one little tiny example. Then you start looking at the vegetables and stuff like that. When things go sideways, it's going to happen very, very fast. You need to pay attention. It's called situational awareness. I've talked about that many times. You need to pay attention. Use your situational awareness, because everybody's in a different boat. Just go 50 miles east of me and they're in a different boat than I am. 100 miles north of me, they're in a different boat. So it's everybody is in a different situation than everybody else is. So each person has to determine for themselves what's necessary for their survival and the people around them. You have to pay attention. The liberal psychosis, which is not a joke, and it's extremely destructive, and it's funny that the rest of us are just allowing it to survive and exist. In any other society, this psychosis that the communists, democrats, socialists, weird creatures. They would never be allowed to be in charge of things. But here, we let them. Pay attention. Hope I see you next week. Keep your nose in the air and your ear to the ground. This is the Armchair Survivalist signing off.